Hey folks, my name is Marcus Peter Rempel. Welcome back to The Ferment. The chapter that I'm sharing with you today is chapter 4 from my book. The title is Sex Fiends, Gian Gomeshi, My Rooster and Me. I've been a bit slow to getting around to uploading this one. Partly that's because in this chapter I talk a fair bit about my own sexuality, which I'm shy of putting out there, even as I felt it necessary to talk about, as I did in the book that I published. Maybe putting it out with my voice attached to it makes it a little bit more personal yet. But there's another reason I've been hesitant. I felt like I owe the listener some update on the Gian Gomeshi story, and I've been struggling with how to point towards that. I looked him up, and I see that he's reinvented himself as the executive producer and primary host, it seems, of something called Roque Media, R-O-Q-E, which is a digital broadcast with a mission to create, quote, an encyclopedia of Iranian diaspora identity in English for a worldwide audience. It boasts over 14 million streams of content so far in less than 3 years of existence. It really looks like Q 2.0, the same kind of dark radio setup. For the studio, the Persian rug underneath the table, Gian's drum kit in the corner along with his David Bowie posters. There's a Meet the Team series of photos where Gian's photo is the same size and dimension as everyone else. There's the first row is Gian plus Pega plus Parissa plus Anahita, quite young, quite attractive looking young women who are working with him. I looked up one of them on Facebook. She has 91 Facebook followers. So much younger than Gian, much less stature. And then the bottom row is the other dudes, who seem to be consultants and kind of tech guys. So in terms of the voices, it's Gian and the ladies. This last piece, I don't know. This is in the about section. Roque Media content is reaching over 120 countries with an educated urban audience that is 75% between the ages of 25 and 45, and over 60% female. I mean, it's very hard for me to look at this and not feel like the high priest of public radio who was caught in a sex abuse scandal has just moved to a new parish and has not really learned much, changed much, but seems to have just kind of relocated his game. Yeah, I mean, it makes me think about cancel culture, about the way cancel culture can hurt. It can hurt small people, but if you're one of the big dogs, you can always find some number of people who either don't know or don't care what sort of trouble you've caused. And there's a frustration there, too, about the way in which bad, dangerous, but successful men can continue to attract a large audience, a significantly female audience, attractive female colleagues who, make some bargain in terms of what they're willing to put up with, what they're willing to be associated with, because they have aspirations and careers that they want to pursue, and they see this alpha male as their ticket up the line. I also notice, as on cue, Gian is hosting some interesting, sophisticated conversations about topics that are worthwhile. And so, of course, yeah, it makes me reflect that one can be a kind, you know, an intelligent, interesting, social justice warrior kind of person and still be a sexual predator. And what does that mean? Anyway, that's where he is now, hosting interesting political conversations for the Iranian diaspora, as well as, I see here, a new series, Unmarried Persian Girls, hosted by three of the female hosts, exploring the lives of young Persian women, contending with traditional expectations and modern realities of unmarried life as Iranian females in the diaspora. I'm just so suspicious of what kind of agenda is going on underneath in hosting those kinds of conversations for someone like Gian. It feels like a kind of dating profile effort with a message that says, hey, look, the girls still like me. So, nuts to all of you who kicked me out of the CBC. I don't know. I'm sure there's some Nietzschean ressentiment in my reactions to Gian. I think there's also a real frustration that it feels like one more cynical, successful public relations makeover rather than a real redemption story, which I think I would have hoped for Gian in the wake of coming to face some of the women who he hurt. And it makes me wonder about how in a mass culture, how can real redemption stories even happen in a marketplace of relationships where it's really not about relationships with real people, it's about collecting likes, collecting subscribers in a very transactional universe, and how hard it is to leave that transactional universe, especially for someone who's become very successful and very skillful in navigating it, into a smaller, humbler circle of real relationships with real accountability, which include real apologies, real sorries, and real new beginnings for sinners, forgiving and being forgiven and moving on. So anyway, those are some updates of the Gomeshi story that you'll hear about in this upcoming chapter. Thanks again for your interest. If you want to support the podcast, I encourage you to go to Patreon and subscribe, or go to the website where there's some buttons that'll take you there. Without further ado, here's chapter 4 of Life at the End of Us Versus Them, Cross-Culture Stories, by yours truly. Chapter 4, Sex Fiends, Gian Gomeshi, My Rooster, and Me. All the heroes, who resemble Joseph, in other words, in myth, are guilty of something. Either they've really done it, they committed the incest, or they didn't do it, and they should have done it. Because it's bad not to have any sexual life. It's like today. You have to be both promiscuous and watch out about sexual harassment, which may be difficult. Because you're in a world where the taboos and the command of promiscuity are always running into each other. René Girard. In November 2014, the Canadian news crackled with a red-hot story when the cultural icon Gian Gomeshi, the hippest, brightest, nicest guy in radio, faced serious allegations of sexual harassment and physical abuse during sex by a growing number of young women. Jessie Brown, the independent journalist who broke the story, interviewed one of Gomeshi's former producers, Robert Very, who came forward to corroborate the story of one young woman, who was a former colleague on Gomeshi's Radio Q, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation's flagship arts and culture digest. When the news hit, Very messaged the woman to apologize for never standing up for her, even though he had witnessed the grinning Gomeshi grab her from behind at her desk and hump her several times. The young woman asked Very to support her now by backing up her story of repeated unwanted sexual contact by Gomeshi. Brown, a former CBC radio producer himself, entitled his podcast, "We All Knew About Gion." It turns out that Gomeshi's reputation for being, quote, too handsy, for dating women he could have fathered, and his penchant for physically aggressive acts were all open secrets inside the CBC. According to Very, when fellow workers wanted to refer to Gion without saying his name, they would make a choking gesture and stick out their tongues, a code that referred to a rumor about Gomeshi nearly strangling a date in an act of erotic asphyxiation. But for the purpose of this investigation, one of the most intriguing things Very said to Brown was an insight comparing the CBC to the big old RCC, the Roman Catholic Church. Very, this stuff happens in institutions. They have not been forced into transparency like, say, a faith community, like the Roman Catholic Church. The Catholic Church, they have safeguards now. If you go see a priest, the door stays open. There's another person in there. Brown. Yeah, protocol. As a result of decades, if not centuries, of institutionalized silence, where everybody understood what you understood, which is, you don't talk about this, because it will come down on you. It won't come down on him. Very. Yeah, they sweep it under the rug. That's what people did with these things 50, 60, 70 years ago. Well, the church got called on it. They can't do it. And I feel like they're atoning for their sins, that they want to be forgiven, that what they did was wrong, and this is how they atone. No such thing exists in media. Brown. If you listen to the CBC, you will hear story after story about gender politics and the abuse of women. But meanwhile, it was happening at the CBC. Very, who no longer works at the CBC, was the only one to respond to Brown's request for interviews with Gomeshi's former co-workers. Even while the CBC ran numerous rape culture stories and other related cultural criticism in the aftermath of Gomeshi's firing, open self-criticism seemed impossible. Aside from the ousted Very, no one at the CBC said, "I was complicit. I saw things that were not right, and I did nothing." The blind eye policy toward their high priest of radio, now glaring, could still not be discussed. In its moment of crisis, the cultural institution charged as the champion for truth, transparency, and accountability went into cover-your-butt mode. Which is natural, since, as Very put it, this stuff happens in institutions. It's a keen insight to recognize cover-ups as innate to institutions, and also to see the CBC and the RCC in parallel. As the church recedes into the background of public life, public institutions like the CBC fill the void. For many Canadians, the CBC is the institution we trust to purvey the truth and shape the collective narrative by chronicling and critiquing other institutions. The CBC tells us who we are. It holds our national leaders to account. It raises up the voices of the unheard, afflicting the comfortable and comforting the afflicted, as Brown himself summarized the journalistic imperative.
I am more familiar with this slogan from the Catholic worker movement, but it fits just as well as the guiding star of the best journalists at the CBC. Yet, as both Brown and Very attested, the CBC's strong moral voice fell silent when it came to sins committed inside its walls. I'm guessing here, but based on Very's comments and his Italian name, I suspect that he is himself a Roman Catholic, at least in background. Perhaps this explains his tone. He was honest about the institutional silence he participated in at the CBC, but he was not scandalized by it. He seemed to have prior experience of institutional hypocrisy as nothing new. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus wrests legitimacy from the dispensers of truth in his culture, the Pharisees. His chief criticism is that the Pharisees built monuments to the prophets whom their ancestors shunned and killed, telling themselves that if those prophets had been alive during their time, they would have exalted them instead of stoning them. Meanwhile, they plot the death of the prophet in their midst. The truth is, no institution likes prophets, and Very understood this. No cultural power likes to be dragged into the light of difficult, embarrassing truths. When the legitimacy of an institutional power is threatened, the most natural thing is to deny, discredit, and attack those who bear witness against them. This is why Gomeshi's female accusers hesitated for so long about disclosing his abuse. This is why National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden is hiding in Moscow from the free nation that has made him public enemy number one. This is why the Pharisees called for Jesus' crucifixion, even while they venerated the prophets who had been killed by previous generations. In all these stories, I see a pattern and a choice. The choice to, like Very, confess complicity in the crimes of our culture, or, like the Pharisee in Jesus' time, or the institutional loyalists at the CBC, follow the pattern of pointing fingers while feigning innocence. When a scandal arises, do we defensively cry, "I am not like those people"? Or do we humbly admit, "I am those people"? The odd trick toward which Jesus hints in his critique of the Pharisees is that the more we say we are not like those people, the more we become them. And the more we confess that we are exactly like those people, the sooner we outgrow their predilections. By openly admitting that he was a bystander to the dehumanization of a colleague, Very ceased being a bystander and became a friend. By suddenly dissociating themselves completely from Gomeshi and refusing the soul-searching questions about their own complicity, the CBC remained trapped in the pattern of cover-up and reputation patrol, which enabled an assaultive, unaccountable superstar to rise in their midst in the first place. Which brings me back to the way that the iconic Gomeshi became a social pariah. This too fits a pattern. The pattern of the scapegoat. The week this story broke, debates on Twitter and Facebook seethed around the question of whether Gomeshi was a victim or a villain in this story. In other words, whom should we sacrifice to resolve this moment of cultural chaos? The fabulous Gomeshi or his female accusers? Up until the story went public, those surrounding Gomeshi were willing to sacrifice and silence those who complained against him. Yet when the silence broke open and the voices against him aggregated, the time came to fire Gomeshi and erase his mellifluous voice from the Canadian airwaves. Gomeshi, of course, cried victim. He was right about this much. His fate was determined by the scapegoat logic that the one should be sacrificed for the peace of the many. But what if the truth is that Gomeshi, like the rest of us, is complex. And none of us can be the first to throw stones. Can't any of us get tangled up in the mess of villainy and victimhood? Don't we all sometimes act nice when it can get us something, and mean when we can get away with it? Is there a sense that Gomeshi is a victim, not of the young women finally calling him to account, but of his own success and ego? Didn't he just do what 1,000 cultural signals tell men to do? Work hard, play hard, fuck hard. Didn't we envy his success, his adulation, the bevy of young women lining up for him? As the Gion Gomeshi scandal spawned a wave of tweets that went viral under the hashtag "been raped, never reported," and our national consciousness was turned to the grievous reality that sexual violence against women is still commonplace across the whole of modern society, I felt shame. But I also felt sympathy for the many men, perpetrators are overwhelmingly male, who commit these acts. For even though I may not have done what they have done, I have felt what they have felt. Not that I want to strangle women, but I know exactly what Bono means when he sings, "I don't believe in forced entry. I don't believe in rape. But every time she passes by, wild thoughts escape. I believe in love. I do believe in love. And I confess that I am a base creature. I need the constraints of culture, the codes of community, as well as spiritual and moral disciplines, to shape the sexual fire within me into a focused flame of love, instead of a consuming, spreading vector of harm. I shudder to think what I would do if I were a high-stakes, high-pressure player like Gomeshi, who rose above humble, accountable membership within a normal human community, into a world of shining lights and mirrors, where he became a superstar rather than a person. An asset too big to fail. A celebrity too valuable to be tarnished. The Gomeshis of this world aren't called in by the company HR department. They are protected from scandal as long as possible, until the dam breaks, and then they are destroyed. In the ancient rites of human sacrifice, the sacrificial victim was often pampered and protected for a prolonged period of time prior to his or her destruction, encouraged in the violation of social taboos, coached in behaviors that aroused fascination, envy, obsession. The first cults of celebrity were cults, literally and exactly. As Gil Bailey observes in a lecture on the Aztec gods, the great ritual of the year, which lasts the whole year, is they bring a prisoner of war from a neighboring tribe, the handsomest prisoner they can get. They dress him up like the god Tezcatlipoca, in the finest of clothes. They teach him to be very elegant and to present himself to others as attractive. In other words, they teach him how to be a dandy. He's observed by others, and he's created in order to be observed by others, and to arouse in others this mimetic desire. Towards the end of the year, he's given the most beautiful women as wives, and he enjoys them in such a way that everybody is fascinated by what's happening, and then at the sacred moment, he comes to the steps of the pyramidal shrine, and he walks up the steps, breaking his flute every step of the way, until at the very top of the shrine, with the sun in the middle of the sky, and the faithful no doubt squinting because of the glare, he's laid on the slab, and a priest takes an obsidian knife and cuts out his heart. That's the transcendentalizing of desire. And it only works if we don't uncover the truth about it. End quote. Some things change, some things stay the same. Whether it's an Aztec sacrifice, Gomeshi's fall from grace, or any scandal in the grocery checkout tabloids, the tipping point between adulation and execration remains balanced on a knife's edge, sharp enough to satisfy the high priest of any of the old blood-craved gods. Several months after the Gomeshi scandal, 50 Shades of Grey opened in theaters across the continent. In this R-rated movie, a, quote, jealous, controlling, sadistic, hypersensitive, moody, power-wielding male is presented as an attractive lover, just in time for Valentine's Day. I don't know much about this movie, except that it involves sadomasochistic sex fantasies, and that Gian Gomeshi referenced the book to describe his relationships with women back when he was still fighting for his life in the court of public opinion, instead of awaiting his day in a court of law. As a celebrity, Gian has now been banished to the outer darkness. Even his archival presence has been erased by the CBC. I have two young, beautiful daughters, and they are growing up in this world, where the messages about sex are terribly mixed and mixed up. I desperately want rape culture to end. But I know that I cannot simply scapegoat the perpetrators as wave after pornographic wave washes over us all, and the social consensus is to be cool with it. I know I could not handle a movie like 50 Shades of Grey, and I wonder how younger, more unattached males could consume this film without developing dangerous attitudes towards my daughters. Should I naively hope that I'm raising my daughters with enough sense and sheltering to avoid the men who have been infected by pornographic norms? Should I leave these young men to act out their newly acquired fantasies on someone else's daughters? In Pornland, How Porn Has Hijacked Our Sexuality, Gail Dines observes how, quote, the porn industry has hijacked the sexuality of an entire culture and is laying waste to a whole generation of boys. She goes on to say, and when you lay waste to a generation of boys, you lay waste to a generation of girls. Dines, a professor of sociology and women's studies at Wheelock College, deconstructs the cultural messaging to girls and women. Quote, women are told in our society they have two choices. They are either fuckable or invisible. To be fuckable means to conform to the porn culture, to look hot, be submissive, and do what the man wants. That's the only way you get visibility. You cannot ask adolescent girls, who are dying for visibility, to choose invisibility. End quote. In her book, Dines details how the pornification of society has been essential to inculcating a consumer culture and is one of the most profitable and destructive drivers of global capitalism, a phenomenon the left has failed to discern, mistaking freedom of expression for freedom of exploitation. I put my girls in public school last September, after homeschooling them for 6 years. I felt confident that they were ready for wider social opportunities, and had developed a solid enough sense of themselves that they wouldn't get lost in the worst offerings of consumer culture, undeniably a core subject on the real curriculum of our educational system. So far, they seem to be finding ways to be and be seen that convey their physical beauty while expressing / receiving their primary identity more holistically. But they do notice things. They notice in the change room that all the popular girls wear thong underwear, so that nothing will obscure the contours and crevices covered by skin-tight yoga pants. I must confess that I noticed these girls the first day we toured the school with our daughters. And in my heterosexual male brain, a signal registered powerfully. These girls were making sure that they were not invisible. And whether they intended to or not, Dines would suggest that they were sending another message as well. That message registered in my brain as well. There. I said it. I'm scared to say it, because I don't want people to know my sexual thoughts, or how often they cross my mind. I'm scared of the shame. I'm also scared of giving these thoughts even more reality by playing around with them out in the open. And I'm scared of scaring the women in my life. I know I would feel safer, and they would feel safer, if we could focus our anxieties on the sexual transgressors outside our circle, rather than the enemy within. But once you become aware of the scapegoating mechanism, you can't unsee it. You see it everywhere. I've been learning about hormones, oxytocin in particular. This is the hormone that facilitates cooperation, bonds mom and baby, signals friendship. Think of it as a tribal hormone. That good feeling you get when you win someone's trust. That's oxytocin giving you that buzz. But in human groups, who trusts who is also closely tied to power plays and exclusion stratagems. Just watch any episode of Survivor. Oxytocin accentuates not only who's in, but also who's out. The same biological mechanism that helps us befriend the other helps us unfriend the other. The same stuff that makes us nice makes us nasty. Once you've perceived someone as arrogant and unconcerned with the welfare of others, oxytocin increases your feelings of envy when they are succeeding, and it also increases your feelings of pleasure when they fail. I imagine there was a fair bit of oxytocin flowing in the coffee room among Gomeshi's underlings the day he got canned. There are also differences in how oxytocin affects male and female brains. In women, the capacity to discern kinship is especially enhanced. In men, it produces a keener sensitivity to the signs of intergroup conflict. I think this may have something to do with why my male buddies and I can go on and on about politics, the troubles on the edge of our tribe, and why we tend to defer to the women in our lives about dilemmas of the closer polity, delicate matters on the inside of the tribe. Before I go any further, I should say clearly, just because something is natural to us doesn't mean it's good, or better said, that it is fulfilled. Here, I am falling back on theology, because I don't see any other way to have a serious conversation about what is good, a value, and what is natural, a fact, without confusing the two or lying to ourselves. We can't choose our facts, but we have to choose our values. I thank the Catholics for articulating this nature-goodness issue carefully and precisely. According to Catholic teaching, all creation is fundamentally good, but also unfinished. Nature is perfected by grace. This saves us from an anti-nature stance, on the one hand, and a nature-is-everything stance, on the other. It means, when it comes to our bodies and our brains, and the funny and frightening things they are prone to, especially sexual things and aggressive things, that there is no shame in what we are, but that there is curiosity, openness, and longing for what we are not yet. In the words of St. John, "Beloved, we are God's children now. What we will be has not yet been revealed." That said, here's what I am. Male. And never mind about what oxytocin does to me. The big hit to my system comes from testosterone, the male sex hormone. My wife has it too, but I have about 7 or 8 times of the stuff coursing through me. It makes my beard and body hair grow. It made me taller and stronger than I would have been otherwise. It does stuff to my brain. It makes me cocky, as in, like a cock, a rooster, strutting, scrappy, aggressive. The strongest difference between the sexes is in our levels of aggression. Testosterone is linked to aggression, overconfidence, and a willingness to attack without provocation, especially when it is acting on male brain structures. Sound like some guys you know? That stuff is baked into me, and baked into my sexuality, into my gendered sex, and into my drive for sex. Testosterone flicked a switch in my head when I was 13. I can remember walking down the hallway in junior high, and suddenly seeing female bodies, having thoughts and desires I had never known before. That's all still there. The result of millions of years of natural selection. And this means that while my commitment is fidelity to my wife and safety to other women, there remains in the background of my personality, even my personhood, a drive to win, woo, and mate. A biological program to implant as many Marcus Juniors in as many healthy female hosts as possible before I die. It's the only kind of immortality my body knows. I could hate myself for this, but it wouldn't change much. More importantly, it would be a blasphemy against the goodness of creation. Just as it is vitally important to name as natural and basically good the sexuality of LGBT sisters and brothers, and to proclaim release from the fear and self-loathing they have suffered for their sexuality, it is also vital for cisgendered men to speak honestly and without shame about our sexual dynamics. Honesty about what is going on in our bodies and our brains, rather than silence, is an essential condition for moving out of sexual violence into sexual health. But how do we do this and keep the conversation safe? I have received more feedback and rewritten this chapter more than any other part of this book. With so much sexual and relational trauma, this conversation triggers powerful emotions, especially fear, among both men and women. So instead of talking about men, perhaps I'll talk about a real cock for a while. We have a rooster at our farm. He is terribly politically incorrect, but we like him. He is funny to us instead of scary. He has a certain charm. He struts and he preens. He holds his head high. He makes a big noise. He thinks he's all that. If he were a man at a party, he'd be an ass. But he is small and demands his center stage only in front of an audience of laying hens, who seem reassured by his magnanimous presence. So we smile and shake our heads at his sexual politics, so simple and antique. Our rooster is classically chivalrous. When there are treats in the chicken yard, he stands there, announcing and presiding over the feast, making sure that each of his ladies gets a share. If there is an intruder, at least a smallish one, like a cat, he runs it off. But here's where things get less charming. For in exchange for his favors and protections, he insists on rough and frequent sex with every female in the flock. There is nothing consensual in these encounters. He bites down on the comb of the hen to balance himself and subdue her. Recently, we lost a hen to complications from a torn comb that he kept aggravating. But this was not a moral flaw in him. He was just doing what a rooster does. Her death was a cultural flaw on our part, a flaw in our animal husbandry. We should have taken better care of that hen. The stuff that makes our rooster a rooster and not a hen, what makes him strut and screw and fight, is the same stuff that makes me a man. The same stuff that secretes out of his testes into his bloodstream, secretes out of my testes into mine. Thank heaven, or evolution if you prefer, for the relatively higher proportion between brain and testicular tissue in my case, for in his, it's about 1-to-1. But I do recognize something about myself, about my male essence, when I watch our rooster. My appetites, compared to my wife's, are urgent, insistent, pushy even. Sexual patience was a discipline of love that took a long time to learn. It has had happy rewards, but it did not come without teaching. My urgency, on the other hand, was not taught. What shall I do with the raw maleness I know in myself, and which I recognize so clearly in our small-brained cock, as well as in the aggressive, molesting Gomeshi? Hate it? Deny it? Decry it in other males and hide it in myself? Loving our enemies is hard, but it is also part of our salvation, because our hatred for our enemies is caught up inextricably with something we hate in ourselves. Something we want to destroy, but which needs to heal. If you want a non-aggressive rooster, you can caponize him. A capon is a male chicken with his testes cut out, which is a common practice in raising meat birds. A castrated male grows bigger than hens, and faster, and more tender than an intact male, who burns off a lot of calories crowing, chasing females around, and fighting other cocks. Some of us are afraid of biological talk about the sexes. We fear, rightly, that this opens the door to a biological determinism that allows for neither human freedom nor conscience. Only nurture must enter the conversation, because nature is scary. Yes, nature is scary. And good. And it is what we are made of, even if it remains for us to discern what we are made for. To flee into a biology-denying discourse is to imply that the solution for the sexual violence committed by men is some kind of cultural caponization. To deny male nature would require denaturing males. It would spin us once more around that now broken wheel, which is about to fall off entirely. The cycle by which we try to contain violence with violence. In any moment of crisis, it is very difficult not to cast about for a clear culprit. or a clear category of culprits to take the rap. For centuries, women have borne the brunt of the blame, punishment, and suffering when something went wrong with sex. My parents can remember tearful young girls, pregnant out of wedlock, confessing their sins to the congregation and the formal proceedings to have these young women reinstated into good standing in the church. For as much silence as there was about the role of the young fathers in those pregnancies, those girls could have made a case for their innocence by claiming immaculate conception. It has always been the girl's fault. How she dressed, how she made eye contact, where she went unaccompanied, how she talked, how she walked. Girls and women have been the scapegoats for rapes, unwanted pregnancies, unsatisfying marriages, infidelity, and marital abuse for millennia. I don't want to go back there. But I have to say, the way women dress, the way they smile, the way they make eye contact, the way they walk, the way their bodies move, curve, sway. These things hit me with a kind of physical shock. Sometimes this can be harmless and enlivening. Often it is significantly distracting. At its worst, it is frightening. That rooster is always there somewhere, pacing around my brain and blood, on the lookout for a fast lay. I can feel the fear rising around me as I say these things. I myself am frightened by things I have said, which I have often thought, but mostly kept to myself. Maybe I should be discussing this behind closed doors, in a men's group. But we aren't going to figure this stuff out in gendered silos. What we need is a more honest and open conversation. We need that conversation to walk the fine line between an honesty that is safe and an honesty that is accusatory. What makes the conversation about male experience so frightening is that we can scarcely imagine a resolution to our social crisis without a scapegoat. If we can't blame the boys, we'll have to go back to blaming the girls. If we don't silence the men, we'll have to silence the women. There has to be another way. Provisional thoughts. It was really my fault that our hen was killed by our rooster's roughness. She had been healing, hidden away in one of the nesting boxes, where Jen was supplying her with a little stash of food and a handful of snow to keep her hydrated. One day, when I was covering for Jen's chores, I forgot about these special provisions. That evening, I found the hen laid out in front of the chicken's water bucket, her skull poked in and her eye poked out. Had the hen been strong and healed, the rooster's roughness would have been no more than a brief interruption of her day, something to put up with and shake off. But she was vulnerable and weak, and so it brought about her death. Should I have killed the rooster? No, but I should have been more mindful of his predilections and the hen's vulnerability. I should have remembered my wife's wise arrangement. If we are going to find our way into a peaceable togetherness as males and females, we may need to arrange some special protections for females and some special accommodations for males. These may need to include some female modesties that preserve males from more arousal than they can handle. They may need to include some customs that keep special watch over females venturing into spaces populated by overexcited males. It may not be fashionable, but it may be wise to return to a more careful, drawn-out courtship, where our subtle, often confusing, signals can be learned bit by bit, where trust can be built stepwise, where small foibles and hurts can be learned from and mended. We may have to accept a slower, more guarded progression toward the full unleashing of human passion in order to save what can be so joyous from what can turn so disastrous. And in pursuing a life of joy, instead of an obsession with moments of excitement, we may find it necessary, and also finally lovely, to ground and celebrate this union in the blessing of friends and family, without which no such union survives for long. And here I see I am already creating a new stumbling block, for I've sown the seeds of a rule, a law to be policed, with infractions to be punished. Let me hastily beat a retreat to the wisdom of St. Paul, who adamantly insisted that any Christian form of togetherness could not be organized under law, but must be bound up in grace. My intent is not to make a rule, but to reopen old wisdoms to a new, more gracious integration. Returning to my teachers, quote, a requisite for the cultivation of the atmosphere I've been speaking of is a willingness to accept discipline without formally stated rules, as Illich says. And Girard would remind us that Christian disciplines are emphatically self-disciplines, and that the way out of the mess that happens when desires turn destructive is not the impossible extinguishing of human desire, but rather its reorientation toward a model so high above us that our desire can never turn grasping or violent. For there is one thing that can satisfy love, and that is you alone, prayed Thomas Merton. That prayer has protected my marriage and my friendships with other women far more than any gender segregation or dress code. But there are habits and practices which do help. The good of all concerned may prompt us to a little strictness in order to amend faults and to safeguard love, St. Benedict says. The old consensus imposed on the immediate wants of individuals some hard-won wisdom of an encompassing collective. Today, such attitudes stand condemned as sexist, inherently oppressive. And certainly there is a skepticism of this tradition that is absolutely necessary. We cannot go back, must not go back, to a culture obsessed with controlling and containing female sexuality, one that transfers them from one domineering man to another as chattel. But not all our current troubles with sexual violence stem from carrying on our elders' teachings for too long. Some of our current troubles stem from our dismissal of our elders' wisdom and our dishonesty about ourselves. As Girard points out, the scapegoating liberals are most prone to is ancestor scapegoating, treating our elders as fools and Pharisees, obstacles to progress, and as a convenient distraction from our own foibles. One elder who, without apology, has the simple sense not to dismiss a practice just because it is well established, is the agrarian writer Wendell Berry. He has reflected on the endless arguments about transgressive contact in transitory encounters between men and women, and has concluded that the cultural experiment in private sex is failing. Sex is the community's business, he says. Any sustained and sustainable culture has made it so. In resistance to a culture that consumes without forethought of tomorrow, and in the interest of domestic pleasures that can last, Berry asks, what must we do to earn the freedom of being unguardedly and innocently naked to someone? Our own and other cultures suggest that we must do a lot. We must make promises and keep them. We must assume many fearful responsibilities and do much work. We must build the household of trust. Note that this argument makes no recourse to tropes such as God's blueprint for the family, which substitute theophany for thought. But neither does it submit to the equally thoughtless revision of sexual norms, which have come about because we saw something new and exciting on TV, put there by somebody who wants to sell us something. Our official modern policy of averting problems with sex has come about through the combined assumptions of perfect technology and perfect individualism. Through various methods of contraception, technology has made it possible for sex to be safe. No STDs, no unwanted babies. But that still leaves open the questions about the meaning of sex. Where does sex belong? Who should have sex with whom? What constitutes a betrayal of a sexual relationship? What is moral sex? And what is immoral? Our culture has boiled down all these complex questions, upon which older cultures have had a great deal to say, to a single question about consent between two, or more, good grief, autonomous individuals. In modern parlance, the aggression of Gion Gomeshi's sex, the inconstancy of his sexual relationships, and the chasm of age, prestige, and power between himself and his young consorts cannot be considered problematic in and of themselves. All that seems to matter is whether or not his sadomasochistic, casual, groupie celebrity hookups were consensual. His problem, and his only problem as far as his liberated critics are concerned, is that he did not understand the meaning of consent. That consent to one act was not a consent to all acts. That consent could be withdrawn. Consent, it would appear, is the only remaining moral category. Everything else is a matter of preferences and individual appetites. Elvira Kurt, Gomeshi's regular comedic guest and one of the only personalities on Radio Q to risk any overt discussion about the suddenly absent star host, emphasized consent as the absolute crux of the issue. In her weekly Cultural Hall of Shame, after Gomeshi's firing, she shamed Christmas party mistletoe drones, a new technology that sends a sprig of mistletoe to hover over guests' heads at office holiday parties, instigating the traditional titillating kiss under the mistletoe, a situation rife with pressures for less than consensual intimacy. Kurt's not-so-tongue-in-cheek proposal was to hand out consent air horns to ensure that office party kissers would communicate clear and unambiguous consent prior to any smooch. This was her way of saying something lighthearted about the catastrophe of Gomeshi's transgressions against the primary and singular code of modern sex, which was his overriding of consent. What struck me in Kurt's proposal was her movement from sexual consent as a private act to sexual consent as a public act. Around this same time, I heard the story of a college that was encouraging affirmative consent contracts among its students. Affirmative consent raises the bar of consent from no means no to yes means yes. Instead of assuming consent until a sexual partner gives a definite negative signal, the new policy denies consent unless it is communicated openly and enthusiastically. In a court proceeding over an allegation of sexual assault, the onus is no longer on the victim to prove the absence of consent, but on the defendant to prove that consent was obtained. A document in writing is the safest practice. On the one hand, such a policy admits that we cannot put the question about the legal and moral appropriateness of sex onto mostly nonverbal signals exchanged between two individuals in the heat of passion, often nowadays strangers, who have only just met. The push towards a publicly recognizable, documentable yes to one another approaches the meaning and function of what used to be held out as the best context for sex, an exchange of vows before a witnessing community. On the other hand, this approach makes the singular focus on consent even more fraught and more disconnected from the reality of human sexuality. I am very grateful to have had to do the legal paperwork just once to share a bed with my wife. I don't imagine the constant pen and paper preliminaries to be a lot of fun for those college kids who are trying to be as sexually active and as litigiously well-prepared as this culture is telling them to be. Indeed, there is pushback and confusion. One college-aged male responded anonymously to the issue of affirmative consent legislation. He writes, "I was raised by a left-leaning feminist family who, at least I thought at the time, were relatively open about sex. But while I arrived at college with a healthy respect for women, I was totally unprepared for the complex realities of female sexuality." "Oh," sighed one platonic female friend, after we had just watched Harrison Forbe grab Allison Duty and kiss her in Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade. "Why don't guys do that kind of thing anymore? Nowadays they're all too scared." On our second night together, one of my first partners threw up her hands in disgust. "How am I supposed to get turned on when you keep asking for permission for everything like a little boy?" she said. "Just take me and fuck me already." She didn't stay with me for long. This would be a recurring theme. More than once, I saw disappointment in the eyes of women when I didn't fulfill the leadership role they wanted me to perform in the bedroom. I realized that women don't just desire men, they desire men's desire. And often, they don't want to have to ask for it. I also realized that I was in many ways ashamed of my own sexual desire as a man, and that this was not healthy. At this point, I was experiencing some cognitive dissonance with my upbringing, but in time learned to take an assertive lead unless I got a no, or otherwise thought I was about to cross a boundary, as indicated by body language. One night, I ended up back in a girl's room after a first date. Those do happen in college. She had invited me in and was clearly attracted to me. We were kissing on her bed, outer layers of clothing removed. But when my hands wandered downward, she said, "No, wait." I waited. She began kissing me again, passionately. So again, I moved to remove her underwear. "Stop," she said. "This is too fast." I stopped. "That's fine," I said. I kissed her again and left soon after, looking forward to seeing her again. But my text messages received only cold, vaguely angry replies and then silence. I was rather confused. Only many weeks later did I find out the truth from one of her close friends. "She really wanted you, but you didn't make it happen. She was pretty upset that you didn't really want her." "Why didn't she just say so then? Why did she say we were moving too fast?" "Of course she said that, you dumbass. She didn't want you to think she was a slut." End quote. On the website where this letter was posted, many of the comments honed in on the challenge to women to overcome their shame about their own sexual desires and to learn to convey more unambiguous messages. There's something to that, no doubt. But it strikes me that none of the comments questioned if sex on the first date might be a norm with an impossibly short timeline for a man and a woman to get their signals straight. No one seemed to consider how such a fast-paced norm sets up the woman for impossible-to-navigate self-perceptions, vacillating between being a slut or being undesirable, while setting up the man for the legally and socially disastrous consequences of misreading the signals of the poor woman who has internalized the cultural death sentence of being, quote, either fuckable or invisible, as Dines says. Nor did anyone acknowledge the anonymous writer's most perceptive observation, which is that women don't just desire men, they desire men's desire, and often they don't want to have to ask for it. This is a subtle and interdependent picture of sex that I recognize as true to life, as I know it anyways, with the one woman to whom I have ever made love. From this necessarily limited, singular intertwining, I dare to extrapolate that good sex is not entered into by the watertight legal contract between two autonomous parties, but through a whole life shared, where needs are met through patiently acquired mutual knowledge. A knowledge that goes well beyond documentable words and penetrates much deeper than correct politics. Gian Gomeshi was a student of feminist theory. He could talk the talk. He did not transgress because he was a bad student. Rather, he transgressed because he was an excellent student of contemporary culture, of its political correctnesses, and its dirty little secrets. He absorbed into his being the mores of a culture that says one thing and means another. He soaked up a culture that in its news stories warns that women ought to be asked, then in its love stories, never mind its porn, shows that women want to be taken. He internalized a culture that tells men they are bad boys, while also telling them that this is what women like. You're a scoundrel, Princess Leia says to Han Solo. You like me because I'm a scoundrel, he answers, and they kiss. An old movie clip, I know, but I expect similar edifications in 50 Shades of Grey. Gomeshi imbibed a culture that preaches perfect autonomy, but is infected more than ever by an ontological disease. We are not satisfied with the life we have in ourselves and in our being, diagnoses Pascal. We want to lead an imaginary life in the eyes of others. So, we try to make an impression. Gomeshi, a great preacher of freedom and enthusiastic explorer of taboos, was obsessed with his public persona. Only a self completely dependent for its validity on the attentions of other selves becomes so trapped. This herald of freedom, who explored the tantalizing edges of what he called adventurous sex, was as obedient to the gods of consumer and celebrity culture as the handsome Aztec prisoner of war was to the spirit of Tezcatlipoca. Gomeshi studied scrupulously how, quote, to be very elegant and to present himself to others as attractive. He became a cultural phenomenon observed by others and created in order to be observed by others and to arouse in others this mimetic desire. The culture, in turn, supplied him with many young and beautiful women. The weekend Gomeshi made his preemptive Facebook confession of a bondage and domination, sadism and masochism, BDSM fetish, painting himself as the misunderstood victim of a prurient employer. His Facebook page was full of messages from young women telling him that his kinkiness only made him sexier. Gomeshi, like Tezcatlipoca's sacrificial representatives, enjoyed his women in ways that people now find scandalous. But those eager and inviting fans remind us that what we find scandalous is only a hair's breadth away from what we find fascinating, arousing, and enviable. Of course, somewhere in this schmozzle, there were individuals making individual choices. But to fixate on which individual was consenting to what misses entirely the force of the cultural and hormonal maelstrom in which these individuals were awash, as they bowed to impossibly mixed signals about sex and to the seduction of an imaginary life in the eyes of others. Gomeshi and his consorts were snarled and tangled up in the desire to be found desirable in the eyes of an extremely desirable other, who they found extremely desirable because desired by so many other others. The women left their encounters with Gomeshi feeling hurt, frightened, and alone. What did Gomeshi experience after his aggressive demonstrations of sexual and social power? My guess is loathing. Loathing for the many women he could so easily entrance with the godlike costume of his celebrity, and loathing for that constructed artifice, caked layer upon layer over top of a real and human interior that he could not make known. His perfect charade self so encasing an imperfect man that these both, man and costume, he must inevitably have found to be loathsome. Eventually, on February 1, 2015, Gomeshi ascended the steps of our justice system. His day in court threw heat like a furnace, but it shed no light. The judge found it, quote, impossible to determine with any acceptable degree of certainty or comfort what is true and what is false, end quote. Presuming the innocence of the accused until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, he ruled in Gomeshi's favor. A crowd of protesters cried foul outside the courthouse as the sexy celebrity they had once collectively adored became the symbol of male sexual violence they now collectively loathed. During the trial, the female complainants were never contradicted in the allegations that they were assaulted, nor were they shaken into saying that they did consent. Gomeshi's lawyer never put him on the stand and never spoke to the central issue of sexual assault. Instead, she argued, hedged, and attacked everything around the issue of the assaults so doggedly that in the end, the judge found the victim's testimony too inconsistent to be credible. The women were caught out trying to hide or minimize behavior that was in fact normal for sexual assault victims, such as staying in a relationship long after the abuse and trying to normalize the assaults. One of them emailed a photo of herself in a bikini and told Gomeshi, "Good to see you again," and "Your show is still great," after he allegedly punched her in the head and pulled her hair. Another sent a handwritten note to Gomeshi after he allegedly choked and slapped her. Gomeshi's lawyer made her read one line from the note out loud for the court. Quote, "I love your hands." Commentators regretted that, quote, "the very crux of sexual assault, whether or not consent took place, was virtually absent from the proceeding." This was unfortunate since, quote, "the law is clear on consent. Seeing the accused, even having sex with him or her at a later date, does not obviate an earlier assault. Consent cannot be granted retroactively." In the end, the women were re-traumatized. Gomeshi never said he was sorry, and he never had to face up to the women he'd hurt. No doubt, the court proceedings set everyone's healing further back. The law may be clear on consent, but people are not. We are divided within ourselves. What is falling apart under cross-examination is not the testimony of sexual assault survivors, but our modern story about the freely choosing self. Clearly, we are not autonomous, clear-minded, post-Enlightenment choice-makers. Here I am following Girard's mimetic theory, which arrives at a conception of the self that is just as conflicted as the women who stay with men who abuse them. As David Cayley remarks, the huge emphasis placed on choice and decision in our world tends to make us think of the self as something free and sovereign. But if Girard is right, the self is more like an unruly crowd than a serene sovereign. End quote. The love notes after the assaults, the correspondence later among two of the women vowing to, quote, sink the prick, because he's a fucking piece of shit, these mixed signals are a microcosm of the adulation and execration by the masses who followed Gomeshi's fantastic career and then his scandalous trial. They are examples of how the self is exactly like an unruly crowd. Upon Gomeshi, our single sin-eater, we can now load the pains of our sexual free-for-all, where each competes against each for attention, gratification, and respect. The ancient Hebrews dispatched their scapegoat by driving it to the edge of a cliff altogether, forcing it to jump to its own destruction, without any of the crowd having to touch the unclean beast. Yet unlike Tezcatlipoca's proxies, Gian Gomeshi will survive our justice and continue to live among us. Like the rapacious rooster and the sexually aggressive man-spirit in me, our sexual icon turned pariah will not be cleanly expunged from our culture. If not by cutting out the hearts of these culprits, how can we make sex safe? If Girard gives us a more honest accounting of our condition, then there will always be ambiguity about consent. Even in the most intimate moments of courtship, a whole community is present in our heads. Sometimes the voices within are harmonious. Other times, there is a cacophony. Do it. Don't do it. Be adventurous. Be safe. Sex has never stopped being the community's business. There just isn't any consensus about it anymore. Is this normal? One of the complainants asked a friend after reporting that Gomeshi had choked her. What if the friend had said yes? A decade ago, such a reply would have been unthinkable. But with 50 Shades of Grey, BDSM is making a play to become the newest flavor on our ever-expanding sexual palate. Why couldn't BDSM, too, become a new normal? Gomeshi could become to BDSM the heroic martyr that Harvey Milk was to gay rights. There's probably a reputation consultant whispering this in Gomeshi's ear as we speak. At a certain point, more and more choices don't make us free. They make us distressingly unsure about ourselves. The longer the menu of options gets, the more reliant we become on others to make sense of it. Is this normal? Is this cool? Our internal compasses actually get more and more shaky as we are pressured more and more to choose our own path. We find ourselves, quote, driven by all sorts of reactive forces, as James Allison says, which I convince myself are me willing, but which turn out to be me willed. How will creatures such as ourselves make choices that are really free? We might begin by drawing the unruly crowd within out into the open, offering each voice a hearing that does not end in judgment, but rather conciliation, a hearing that draws us from cacophony towards coherence. We have to learn to live together, the unruly crowd within and the unruly crowd without. It will take some discipline to be free. We will have to tell the truth about ourselves before we can be true to ourselves. In that spirit, let's talk about sex.